Our final panelist is Dean Ferguson. After winning both a Bourse Chateaubriand and a Fulbright Fellowship, Dean received his PhD from Purdue University in 1997. He is currently professor of history at Texas A&M University, Kingsville. Dean has published several articles in, among other venues, French Historical Studies, the Proceedings of the Western Society for French History, and the Journal of Global History. His paper is titled, Not Rags to Riches, as I thought it might be, but Rags and Money, Chiffonier and Consumers in the Long 18th Century.
Thank you. Rebecca Spang recently noted how in 18th century France, a functioning and growing economy often coexisted with a chronic shortage of specie, a condition that did not necessarily translate into underdevelopment. This dearth of coin, according to Spang, was largely overcome through intricate credit relationships and cash transactions that dragged on for years. The logic of these credit relationships, Laurence Fontaine likens to microcredit extended in contemporary African, Latin American, and Asian informal sectors, and encompassed such diverse mechanisms as family credit networks, baker's tallies listing bread quantities dispersed to trusted neighborhood residents, dispersals of workers' associations, and pawnbroking or secondhand clothes dealings. For some transactions, however, and for the poor and very poor, coin and small denominations remain necessary. The poor, according to Spang, literally needed money more than anyone else did. Small denomination coins made of low-grade silver and copper and various alloys are therefore much like bread, necessities of the life of the poor. Bernardo Ago has argued that in early modern Rome, where most of the population was excluded from the circulation of money, objects as diverse as silk drapes in the case of high finance transactions, or even foodstuffs for more mundane exchanges, provide examples of what Ago called using things as money. Among the things that might be used as money, I argue in this paper, were things often regarded as refuse, collections of rags, most notably, but also broken glass, kitchen grease, bones, and other waste materials served as a form of in-kind savings, remarkable as a near-liquid asset. What this paper examines, then, are the uses of rags as both a form of in-kind savings and a form of money activated in the relationships between peddlers and chiffonniers and householders and domestic servants who turned rags into money. The process of acquiring rags for paper production was quite well known to 18th and 19th century observers. In his entry on paper, the Encyclopédie Méthodique described in some detail the process whereby paper mills acquired their necessary raw materials. Effectively, rags are collected in the cities and in the countryside by a large number of persons who first form a small heap of rags, then a large one, and finally the whole is taken to storehouses to be delivered to manufacturers. The author then noted that rural districts provided greater quantities of rags as farm work and manual labor in the countryside increased the wear and tear on clothes, laundering was more frequent and debilitating to clothing, and as fewer woolens and finer textiles were worn, supplies of linen and canvas rags were more widely available in rural districts. The entry further emphasized that one of the measures used by entrepreneurs in the paper trade to procure needed rags was to provide small advances to rural women in exchange for consignments of rags at a specified future date. By this method, newly established paper mills were able, by the end of the second year of operation, to secure as many as 8,000 rags per month from a catchment zone of some 8 to 10 leagues distance. Within 2 years, newly opened mills could take in enough rags to enable them to keep 2 vats occupied, dispense with purchases from rag wholesalers, and even maintain a surplus of rags sufficient to sell to their on their own account. The system directing rags toward France's paper mills had developed alongside growth of the nation's paper industry. The earliest French mills were initially welcomed by seigneurial landowners as novel sources of revenue. The right to establish a paper mill often included an attendant monopoly of rags within a designated radius of the mill, usually a distance of half a league. Urban institutions also sought the privilege. In 1669, for example, the Hôpital de la Charité in Montpellier acquired the exclusive right to collect the city's old linens and rags, and the right to sell the accumulation to whomever its rectors wished. The monarchy over the course of the late 17th and 18th century was not infrequently drawn into efforts to regulate the rag trade and to restrict export of the raw material. For the duration of the Ancien Régime, then, access to rags would be subject to the kinds of contestations and claims common in other areas of jurisdictional and economic struggle centering on claims and counterclaims to privilege. Throughout France, as was the case elsewhere in early modern Europe and in colonial America, a variety of figures then were involved in acquiring rags for paper mills and for the lengthy supply chains that made up the national and international market for rags. The chiffonnier was perhaps only the most picturesque of those engaged in collecting rags. Louis-Sébastien Mercier described the chiffonnier as follows. Look at him, this man who, with the help of his hook, picks up what he finds in the mire and throws it in his sack. Don't turn your head away. No pride, no false delicacy. This vile rag is the primary material that will become the ornament of our libraries and the precious treasure of the human spirit. This rag came before Montesquieu, Buffon, and Rousseau. Without his hook, my work would not exist for you, reader. The Encyclopédie's note on Parisian chiffonniers describes these workers' routines and the dank environments in which they plied their trade. These poor people go out before daylight through every street using a hook of old iron placed at the end of a baton to pick up every morsel of linen or paper thrown under trash piles. They collect them in a long basket which they carry fastened on their back. When the basket is full of this debris, they dispose of it in cellars that serve as a general reservoir and storehouse of these infected materials. One can hardly conceive of the horrible odor that comes from these rags piled in dark, humid rooms where the sun never penetrates. Imagine all these tissues pregnant with animal materials, urine, excrement, sweat, saliva, etc. As I read that, I don't really want to imagine it, actually. After collecting this mass of rags and before transporting them to manufacturers, the entry then describes how a triage was undertaken, separating the different qualities and varieties of rags, as well as separating other waste materials, as each served as a raw material for different industries and varieties of paper. The Parisian piqueur, while iconic, was not perhaps the most important supplier of rags. Breton paper mills, for example, were serviced by rag collectors known locally as pellier or stoupe, who scoured Lower Brittany for rags, scrap metal, and other materials, acquiring these recyclables in exchange for fruit in summer or crockery in winter. The practice was evidently an ancient one, as early as the 13th century, according to one report. Rag gatherers were already exchanging needles for worn garments and rags. Similar practices were evident in many parts of France. Jean-Élie Bertrand, in his Description des Arts et Métiers, described how the rags of the Rhône-Alpes region were acquired and transported to Auvergne's papermakers. Merchants from Lyon have the rags of the Lyonnais, Dauphiné, Bresse, and above all Burgundy, gathered to furnish the manufacturers of the Auvergne. Patière, chiffonnière, and drapelière cover the villages, collecting pâte or chiffon, sometimes even in street rubbish, often by giving a few needles to domestics or the poor who don't know what is done with the rag. A yard of lace worth 2 or 3 sols will sometimes buy a considerable quantity of rags. Even more attention is paid to this in cities. There are rarely not merchants who gather with care old linens that people sell them and put them in storehouses from where they are transported to the Auvergne on mules. Bertrand's description illustrates the role of urban merchants in provisioning peddlers with consumer items that might be acquired in trade for rags, which in turn were sold to interested papermakers. These same merchants also took in rags as partial payment for small purchases or paid sums of petty cash to rag collectors and householders. Papermakers also benefited from the well-known patterns of seasonal out-migration from impoverished regions of the country. Abel Poitrineau and these regions produced a host of migrants who worked throughout France as water carriers, sedan chair carriers, shoe signs, porters, or chimney sweeps. In their travels, itinerant laborers often combined peddling and rag collection, keeping a sharp eye out for rags or trading items of commerce for cloth remnants or old linens, which might be sold on their return to paper mill owners. The role of colporteurs in distributing printed material throughout France is widely known. These peddlers were also vital, however, to the supply chains returning raw materials to the nation's paper mills. Jacques Acarius de Serillon, in his Entrée des Nations de l'Europe, characterized these itinerant traders as follows. This sort of colporteur supplies the paper mills, one of the most necessary manufacturers, and the friperie, a branch of commerce which is also of great utility. Given the demand for rags, incentives for institutional and household thrift, and the varied economy of rag collection, what significance should we accord to the rag trade as a vehicle for savings and capital accumulation, or as an engine for petty consumption? In short, to what degree could it be said, as a 19th century observer of Parisian rag pickers suggested, that the labor of a chiffonnier creates capital out of refuse? And to what degree did rags contribute to the purchasing power of early modern consumers? The answer to these questions, I must admit, at this time are very speculative. The value of rags to the chiffonier who collected them from urban rubbish, or to peddlers who traded pins, needles, or crockery for them, or to domestics who preserved household rags to turn into ready cash, or as a barter item, is difficult to determine. The prices paid by paper mill owners to wholesale rag merchants differed significantly from the prices that these varied figures might hope to receive. Nonetheless, it is possible to speculate both at a local level and on a macroeconomic level about the quantity and value of rag harvests. A statistical survey of the Département de Lot-et-Garonne carried out in 1801, for example, offers one glimpse of the potential significance to that region's households of rags and other recyclables. The Département counted 11 manufacturers, all small artisanal operations with only 13 vats employed. The mills, nonetheless, in 1801 worked 10,800 quintals, over 1 million pounds of rags, largely acquired locally. According to the report, rag purchases represented a disbursement to area households of 130,000 francs. The report also noted, in addition to this sum, 40,000 francs paid out for the collection of broken glass and cinders. While pre-revolutionary evidence rarely provides such clear estimations of similar disbursements, it is possible to generalize about the quantities of rags likely collected in 18th century France for sale to paper manufacturers. The quantity of rags required to maintain a one- or two-vat paper mill appears to have remained relatively stable over the course of the history of artisanal paper production before the early 19th century's expansion of mechanized paper. The quantities of rags employed by local paper mills, however, provide a rough measure of quantities of rags saved or collected from a mill's surroundings, or perhaps acquired in the regional, national, and sometimes international rag markets. The quantities of rags needed by individual mills can be seen by looking at a selection of contracts recorded between 1450 and 1800. In a contract dated the 12th of June, 1451, Martin Georges recorded the acquisition of 30,000 pounds of fine linen rags and 5,000 pounds of coarse rags, purchased for delivery to a papermaker in Metz. In a similar contract over a century later, Jehan Bangeg promised to deliver all the drapeaux necessary for making paper that he was able to collect during the coming year and deliver them to Jehan Hem, a paper seller. The latter annually required a total of 600 quintals of rags valued at 825 livres per year. Evidence from the 18th century suggests that the quantity of rags needed to keep a paper mill open year-round had not increased substantially. In 1760, a partnership formed to establish a mill in the Finistère calculated the capital investment necessary to initiate production at 40,000 livres. In addition to costs of construction and the salaries and living expenses of 20 employees, the investors counted among their startup needs 50,000 pounds of rags for a total of 25,000 livres. Jean-Élie Bertrand in 1776 contended that in order to keep a paper mill open year-round without interruption, 600 quintals of rags are needed, roughly the same as were seen in the 16th century and 17th century. Of the 7,269 livres that made up the entire cost of operating a paper mill, Bertrand counted the cost of rags at 4,800 livres. If there seems to have been relatively little increase in the quantities of rags needed by individual mills in the early modern period, the same cannot be said of the demand for rags in the aggregate. Warren Scoville has argued that the 18th century was characterized by increasing paper production, featuring both a slight growth in the size of operations and more typically a growth in the number of paper mills. Despite growth in the average number of vats, Scoville contends that most paper makers in 18th century France worked one vat, producing anywhere from 2 to 10 reams per day, 600 to 3,000 reams per year, though official characterizations of output typically range from 2,000 to 3,000 reams per year for each paper mill. By weight, these estimations imply that a typical paper mill produced between 10 and 25 tons of paper annually. Following a late 17th century downturn in production, French paper output doubled between 1720 and 1789. The growth was accompanied by increased efforts to conserve rag supplies and to remove hindrances to internal traffic in the raw material. On the eve of the Revolution, France remained the largest European paper producer. The number of mills operating in France had grown from perhaps 300 mills in 1700 to 600 by the last third of the century. Growth of this sort would have necessitated an increase in the harvest of the kingdom's rags from nearly 19 million pounds of rags to over 38 million pounds at 600 quintals per mill. This latter figure accords well with Auguste Lacroix's estimation offered in 1863 that French papermakers a century earlier had consumed 20 million kilograms of rags annually. In Nicolas Demarest's Second Memoir sur la Papeterie, published in 1778, he observed that France's 400 vats worked an average 50,000 pounds of rags annually, a total of some 20 million pounds of rags. A decade later, he would offer a second estimation. He suggested that the kingdom had no fewer than 900 vats at work, each employing some 40,000 pounds of rags. Given his varied calculations, the required rags needed to maintain production amounted to some 38 million pounds of rags of all qualities. Pierre-Claude Reynaud lists the number of operating mills in France on the eve of the revolution at between 700 and 750, with a total output of between 6,000 and 10,000 tons of paper. Based on the assumption that that at this date, for every pound of paper produced, between 1.5 and 2 times the quantity of rags were required, it would be fair to estimate that France's paper producers needed between 9,000 and 20,000 tons of rags annually in 1789. It's perhaps impossible to establish a definitive claim for the value of these rags collected in the latter part of the 18th century, but taking Pierre-Claude Reynaud's price soundings in the Auvergne and uniting them with estimations about the quantities of rags collected and sold offers the opportunity to speculate about cash inflows into the French economy deriving from the rag trade. Between 1736 and 1771, according to Reynaud, prices for both paper and rags followed parallel and relatively stable paths, with the price paid for rags in the Auvergne hovering at between 12 livres, 16 sous, and 15 livres per quintal. In 1788, according to Reynaud, a quintal of rags sold for 15.7 livres tournois. Using his contention that France's 700 to 750 mills produced above 14 million pounds of paper, the industry consumed perhaps 28 million pounds of rags annually, valued wholesale at perhaps as much as 4.4 million livres. At this point in my research, I'm unable to make any statement about the sums that the chiffonnier who sifted through urban refuse might have received for the contents of their hôte, or the purchasing power domestics or households might have commanded from collections of rags. However, it's fair to suggest that the variable capital created from the refuse was not insignificant and served well as a form of petit monnaie circulating through urban and rural microcircuits. Ambroise Firmin Didot, scion of the famous 19th century French paper-producing family, in his Essai sur la typographie, made the following observation, often repeated by other paper producers. The price of rags is the principal base of the price of paper, and conforming to the general law, the value of rags almost always corresponds to the degree of wealth and prosperity of diverse peoples. The collections of what were otherwise waste materials thus represented an important capital made available to producers as varied as paper mill owners, wig makers, or sugar refineries. They also represented, as Firmin Didot makes clear, an important indicator of the wealth and prosperity of the nation.